Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I have to tell you, as it's an election year, we're going to be talking to a lot of candidates. We've invited Democrats to come on the show. They are always invited to come on the show. And in fact, if they just happen to call in, I'd be glad to talk to the Democrats. Most of them do not want to answer the kind of questions that I would ask. And I promise you, my staff knows this, my producers, they know that if I got a Democrat on this program, I'd be as nice as pie. I'd be so polite. I would ask tough questions, but I would be so polite. Democrats don't even want that kind of question because, frankly, most of them do not have answers for the questions that I would ask. But I thought we'd talk to John Masterman, who's the Republican candidate for Oregon State Rep for House District 48. John, welcome to the program, or welcome back to the program.
Well, good afternoon, Lars. Thank you very much for having me on.
Now, you've identified education. I'm glad to have you on. You've identified education as one of the biggest problems Oregon has. Well, Oregon and Washington have both got such a stack of problems. I don't know if we can say one is bigger than the other one, but that's one of the areas where you're focusing. What do you propose if you get elected to House District 48? What do you plan to do about it?
Some of the basic components are the parents are in charge of their kids' education. The government doesn't have the right to hijack that. And parent rights in education are being chipped away piece by piece. If you object to an offensive book in an elementary school library, one that is so offensive that you cannot read it in front of a school board meeting, you get told that you are a book banner. Well, no, I would call that a concerned parent. Now, that's important. Oh, lost my train of thought.
Well, you're making a point because I know I see book ban in headlines on the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper on television and everything else. And I keep thinking this is about age appropriate. I mean, my little 8-year-old granddaughter, Payson, if she came over and she had some of her friends at the house, you know, and I was put in charge of these kids. And the parents came back later on and they said, so what'd you guys do tonight? And I said, oh, I let him, and Payson, by the way, is 8. And I said, I let him watch The Exorcist tonight. What would you think of that decision, John?
I think that wasn't appropriate, not for the age. That's why there's ratings on there. And as a parent, it's your job to monitor that and enforce that.
Yeah, and you say that's not age, nor would be Saving Private Ryan, which is a fantastic movie, whereas The Exorcist is not that fantastic. But Saving Private Ryan is a great movie, but not for 8-year-olds, right? And the schools just absolutely refuse to acknowledge that, don't they? Well, most of them do.
Yeah, it seems to be the closer you get into the urban areas, the more problems that you have. You know, when I went to school, you know, admittedly, it was a couple years further back than most, had kids later in life. But what worked then can still work now, and how do we drift that far off? You know, we did things that are crazy by modern standards. We said the Pledge of Allegiance every morning in grade school. We learned about reading, writing, math, geography, science, history, civics, finance, all things that kids are going out into the world these days, and they don't have any testing available to show they have any competency in these areas. I mean, sure, lots of them do, but there's no testing. There's no backstop. Graduation standards have been removed. The authority to do so was passed off to the Oregon Department of Education last year, and they suspended standards for 4 years. So there's no proficiency requirements at all, which makes a diploma become a participation trophy.
So how do you fix that, John? Because I think the fix is I think you have to threaten the existence of the public schools. And by that, I mean, you have to say to them, we're going to let parents leave with their kids and take a chunk of the money with them that ordinarily funds public schools. And if they choose to go to a private school, a parochial school, an online school, a charter school, whatever they want to go to, they can go to that. If you actually threaten the existence, I mean, and you say, well, that's harsh. Well, I would say that if you're at a job and you're doing something colossally stupid, your boss might say, you know what, go home. You're taking a day off without pay. If you do something even dumber, he'll give you a week off without pay. And you know, at that point, you may get forever off without pay. You may get a pink slip. And with that threat, you know, because, which everybody knows can be laid by any employer out there, you can say, or the employee can say to the boss, hey, you keep making me do this stuff that I think is wrong, illegal, immoral, whatever. I'm going to go to work for somebody else. And every employer knows that. So it's a fairly equitable relationship and it stays that way. But if every employer knew I can abuse my employees as much as I want and they can't leave and they can't object to it, well, the schools are in that position. We can do anything we want to your kids and you can't do anything because we've taken away all other options except public school run by governments. Put them in fear of for their existence and they will change or they will die as a school, you know, one or the other. Now, can we ever get to school choice the way so many other states around America have offered parents and students school choice?
Well, thank you for taking care of the full-on, in-depth version of what my answer was.
It really is simple. Sorry about that,
school
John.
Choice.
It gets me fired up.
Well, this is a free market country. A little competition will sort everything out. I don't have to have the specific answers to what exactly needs to be changed in the public school system. But if you have a high cost and a poor product, and you have a competitor come along that has a good quality product at a fair price, where are the customers going to go? At that point, you have two options. You either improve your product or you go out of business. It's really that simple. And supporting IP5 and IP6 is a wonderful way to do that. Legislatively, I don't think in the Oregon environment you could ever push this through, but there is a rock-solid effort with IP5 and IP6 to get both open enrollment and school choice on the ballot. And those two items right there would pretty much take care of everything if just let run their course.
You know, it'd be an interesting experiment. Washington State has this initiative to the legislature. Oregon does not. Oregon has the referendum the legislature can initiate. What do you suppose would happen if you brought IP5 to the next legislative session and said, hey, here it is. Do you want the people to vote on it or should we beat them to the punch and vote it through as law now? And get your Democrat colleagues to all vote against it, which they will, and say, no, we're not doing it. Then the public's message will be even louder. You had the chance to fix it. You claim to have run for a leadership position in the legislature to do that, and you refused to do that, and now the public have done it for you.
Well, with a Democrat majority in either of the chambers in Oregon, they choose the speaker and they choose the agenda. So there would never even be a discussion on that. It would get kicked out. It would never even make it out of a committee, I would imagine. But it certainly wouldn't come up for a vote. They wouldn't. They don't want the optics on that because it doesn't fit the agenda. So they wouldn't even let it come up and get any air.
You know, and that's what's sad about it, John. John, will you tell people where to find your website so they can find out more about your candidacy?
Definitely. VoteForJohnMasterman.org. That's vote, F-O-R, JohnMasterman.org.
Very good. John, good luck to you. And I'd love to see a way to force the legislature to have to take a vote on it. But it doesn't even work in Washington State because they put six initiatives to the legislature, and the legislators only deigned to even vote on three of them. So they basically said to the public and to the state constitution, to hell with you, we're not even going to do what the Constitution says. And they were all Democrats, by the way. Back in just a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You got the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Sleepy Joe was on Jeopardy.
This man, also known as the worst president in United States history, loves ice cream, lounging on beaches, and sniffing children. Joe.
Who is me? Wait, where am I?
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. If you want to jump into what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you want to send an email, talk@LarsLarson.com. If you're a naysayer, dial me up at 866-439-5277. We always put naysayers right to the front of the line. I've warned you before that I think that unions are doing tremendous damage to your children's education. And for those of you who don't have biological kids in the schools right now, they're wasting your money big time. And we saw great evidence of that during the pandemic when the teachers' union said, well, it doesn't save lives, but we want extended school closures, I think for some very selfish reasons, unfortunately. So I thought we'd talk about that with Ashley Varner, who's Vice President of Communications and Federal Affairs at the Freedom Foundation. Ashley, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having the Freedom Foundation back on, Lars. And you have been such a patriot and a stalwart talking about protecting our kids and getting the teachers' unions out of education. Thank you for all your work.
Yeah, sadly, I always thought we could get the teachers' unions out. Now it sounds like we just have to get the kids out, leave the teachers' unions where they lay, because they're in there for the long haul, it seems. But are we finally getting some school districts and maybe some media to admit that the school closures were a disaster and they didn't do any good?
You know, Lars, that's a hesitant yes. We are finally getting some media to admit that, because the New York Times came out with a report just recently saying, oh, wow, this was bad for the kids behaviorally, mentally, emotionally, and educationally. And when the New York Times admits it, you know it was really, really bad. But, Lars, you are not part of the legacy media. But the legacy media watches what the New York Times says. So when the New York Times says something, it's okay for the rest of them to talk about it. So what we're hoping is the New York Times has said, oh, yeah, school closures were really bad for kids. And we didn't know how bad until now, but it was bad. So we're hoping that the rest of the legacy media will take the sign of the old gray lady, as they called her.
You know, it's one of the things, Ashley, I've been a journalist for 49 years, and it's one of the things that's always seemed bizarre to me. There's so much of a herd mentality. In fact, there was a guy named Timothy Krause who wrote a book about covering presidential campaigns. It was called The Boys on the Bus, and he'd talk about the fact that he'd come up with unique stories and call his editor, and they'd say, well, it's not on the wires and it's not in the Times, so we're not interested. And then 2 days later, it would show up in the Times or show up on the news wires, the AP and others, and they'd be on the phone yelling at him, how fast can you get that story? There's very much this confirmation that everybody wants to march, to the same sheet of music or sing the same sheet of music. One of the really disastrous things of journalism, and I always thought that when we got to this sort of social media age, when that began to emerge, that you'd see reporters start to break from the pack, saying, I don't want to be reporting the same stories that everybody else is doing. But there is a safety in that, because if you go do a story and your story is pretty much identical, slightly different quotes, slightly different writing, you know, whether it's the New York Times, or the Washington Post, or ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS, etc., that you can say, well, I did the story. It was not much different than anybody else's story, but that means I was doing my job. I thought my job was to break from the pack and tell my audience something they couldn't get anywhere else.
Yeah, no, not enough people are like you, Lars, honestly, which is why we so appreciate getting to talk with you. People take their cues from the New York Times still, for whatever reason, because I don't even know anyone who still has a subscription to the New York Times. I canceled mine last year, to be honest. But the New York Times finally gave people permission to talk about this. And what we're talking about, we're talking around right now, is that test scores among fourth graders and eighth graders in math and reading scores are in the toilet. And we've talked about this before. They're 30 years behind. They've plummeted since the time in the 90s. And I'm okay to say I was in high school then. but we have seen these fourth graders who are now, they have dropped several points. I mean, significant points in reading. where were these fourth graders 4 years ago? Because the test score said since 2020, they've dropped 5 points, 7 points since 2020. They were kindergartners, Lars,
yep,
when we shut down the schools. If we allowed them back in the schools, they had to wear masks. They had to sit behind plexiglass. Their teachers were wearing masks. How in the world could they hear the alphabet? How in the world could they hear their pronunciations and how to put a sentence together? So we're talking about the fundamentals of reading at the most important stage, and they were put in a bad position that they are now, we're seeing, haven't really come out of that. And the eighth graders, they have been tested by what we're calling it is the nation's report card. And these studies, just for your audience, they came out in February. So this is new data. The eighth graders, their math comprehension has dropped like 9 points. And what was going on prior to them getting into the eighth grade? I know a lot of your listeners probably remember the teachers union president of the LA Teachers Union, Cecily Maillart Cruz,
yep,
saying, it's okay that our babies didn't learn their multiplication tables. They learned the word riot. They learned the meaning of insurrection. Oh, no, 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 no. You know what? We're all going to rue the day that our babies didn't learn their multiplication tables, because now in the eighth grade, they're starting algebra and they have no foundational mathematics to learn algebra and go into the higher math skills. These are the people who are going to be building our bridges and our roads and our buildings that all of us are going to depend on for decades to come. So if you have children in the public school system, you should be outraged. We are rightfully outraged. We have all been.
Well, pull them out. What do you think of the prescription? Pull, if you possibly can, homeschool, private school, parochial school, but homeschool especially. It is well within the capability of parents. And if we do that and we send a message to the public schools, you're going to lose the student base, and that means you're going to lose the dollars, then maybe the unions will wake up and say, we have to deliver a quality product for America. We have to deliver education to these kids. And if we don't do it, then American parents are going to abandon us, and school levies are going to fail, and public schools will shut down, and they deserve to. If you lose 5 to 10% of the kids to dropouts, and of the kids who stay behind, maybe a half or two-thirds make the minimum marks to be considered adequately prepared in English, reading, writing, and arithmetic. And if all of that is going on and you're producing that bad a result, nobody wants to fund schools that are like that. That's Ashley Varner. Ashley, thank you very much. She's with the Freedom Foundation. You're welcome to weigh in. 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you're a naysayer, you'll always go first on the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Lars Larson Show. New plan of action. Just mug all the Dems.
I got jumped like 5 weeks ago walking home in New York City. And when I woke up, I genuinely felt like a different person. Because I was on the floor, I was bleeding, I was concussed, and I was 100% Republican.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. You know, pedestrian fatalities are up dramatically, and it's amazing because this is a problem that the city of Portland some time ago, and other major cities have done similar things, said we're going to have a program called, Vision Zero. That is, envision the year where we could have zero of these accidents. And yet the numbers seem to have gone up with help from the government, which I think is probably pretty typical. So I wanted to bring on our friend Aaron Mesh, who's managing editor for Willamette Week, to talk about this story that you can find at WWeek.com. How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm doing all right, but I get frustrated when the government says, we've got a problem and we're going to solve it, and the problem gets worse. Am I wrong in that impression?
No, I think you're correct in that impression. I think, like, let's talk about another set of numbers. So in 2018, the deferred maintenance costs at the Portland Bureau of Transportation, that is the street department, the cost of roads that had degraded because they had not been properly maintained, was $2.6 billion with a B.
Yep.
That very same year, the mayor, Ted Wheeler, said we're going to dedicate roughly $600 million of money that, and it's a complicated formula of how he'd figured out how to assign this, but money that's being freed up from urban renewal areas, tax dollars that used to go into urban renewal but aren't going to go there anymore. We're going to have $600 million that we can dedicate toward this deferred maintenance problem. Well, here we are. It is 6 years later. Guess how much the deferred maintenance backlog.
Now hold on. This is a good one. I can do story problems like this. Six times six would mean they put in $3.6 billion and they have almost entirely caught up their deferred maintenance.
Sorry to tell you that it's actually now $4.6 billion.
So they poured money onto a problem that needed money, and the problem got bigger and not small.
No, actually, they didn't pour any money. So,
that was the part I missed.
The $600 million pledge has evaporated into they have bonded $25 million and have admitted they're not going to do the other $575 million.
Where'd the $575 go? Into somebody's pocket?
It went to Superfund cleanup, to the Housing Bureau, and back into the budget of Prosper Portland, the Economic Development Agency. So it went to other priorities rather than the thing that the mayor said he would protect it from forever.
Yeah, which is why he's probably one of the reasons he's heading out the door at the end of the year, because he's a complete, I don't know how to explain Ted Wheeler. I mean, well-educated at all the best liberal universities like Stanford and Harvard, and he can't seem to find... I'm surprised he can button his shirt in the morning.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily that he's addle-minded. I don't see it that way. I think he's a bright and thoughtful guy. I don't believe that Ted has ever shown a willingness to stick to a plan when it's inconvenient for him.
Oh, well, maybe that's a product of inheriting millions of dollars from his granddad, who actually knew how to work and cut trees for a living. You know, what happens when you're really, really rich? Do you have to make any commitments they actually stick to? You don't even have to show up for work, do you?
I mean, my experience is that these days no one shows up for work unless they work for me.
Okay. Well, and then you make them show up. But so here's the piece of the problem I see. So you've got a growing number of pedestrian fatalities. And I remember a few years ago, I quizzed the department that's supposedly in charge of this. And I said, where are most of the fatalities? And they said, they're on the arterial streets, you know, the big streets you can go 35, 40, 45 miles an hour on. I said, okay, that's where 70% of the fatalities are. Where are the minority of the fatalities? Oh, you know, local residential streets. Okay, so you're going to cut the speed limit on the arterials. And they said, oh, no, that would make people mad. I said, well, where are you going to cut the speed limit? On the pedestrian streets, where only 30% of the problem is. And you're going to leave the speed limits the same on the arterial streets, which I actually applaud. I think the arterial streets should be arterials. But they go out and they do these big deal announcements. We're going to cut all the speed limits. I mean, at some point, they'll have everybody driving through residential neighborhoods at 5 miles an hour, and you'll still have a lot of people being killed on the arterials, and nothing will have changed because they want a solution, but one that's popular. And the problem is a lot of solutions are not popular.
I don't know that I could put it better myself. Like, the degree to which the city is afraid to annoy its own residents to achieve the goals that it wants is a fairly constant refrain. Like, there are lots of things we can do to solve our problems in the city. It's just that the people who live here don't want them.
No, so, you can do things like, let's lock up criminals when crime becomes a problem. Oh, no, we can't do that. We'll put too many black and brown people in custody. And I said, well, okay, but what if that solves the crime problem? Yeah, but it has to fit certain political criteria, too. So then they go with the non-solution that keeps getting people killed or hurt or in the hospital, and they don't solve the problem. And they don't get called out on it by the media.
For an example that will annoy your listeners, because that's my job.
Okay.
You could put a homeless shelter in every residential neighborhood in the city. You could put behavioral health care within the residential neighborhoods of the city. But you try doing it in any neighborhood in the city, and everybody who says they're a liberal suddenly shows up on your
doorstep.
Not in my backyard.
No, but Aaron, I've got a solution to that. If you take the fanciest neighborhoods, I mean, you know, the high dollar neighborhoods of Seattle and Portland and every other city in the Northwest, and you put all the crap there. Put the homeless camp there, put the drug treatment center there. Do you know how fast that problem will get solved? Because the people in those neighborhoods...
For once, you and I agree completely. I would love to see all the homeless shelters placed in the West Hills of Portland.
Yeah, because then the people in the West Hills who do have the money and the influence and the political power would say, you got to solve this problem. You can't be putting these people in our neighborhood. Whereas when you drop it into a neighborhood like Lentz or the Rainier Avenue in Seattle, those people don't have any political pull, power, or anything else, and so they just have to suck it up and live with it.
I think we have achieved consensus and potentially a solution.
Well, let me throw you one other that's really been bugging me, because government often reminds me of the kind of person who buys old cars promising to fix them up, and then they break, and so he parks them in the front yard, and then he buys another one, and they keep piling up in the front yard, and his friends say, why don't you just fix one of them and get rid of the rest of them? The cities keep buying parks, and then they let them fall into disrepair to the point where they're literally deadly, in at least one case you know about, where a light standard fell over and either killed or hurt somebody badly. You say, why don't you fix this? And they say, well, we have about, I think it's $600 million a year, or eight, maybe it's eight, and we have to, but we have to spend half of it on acquiring new parks, while the other half is spent on maintaining the parks, and they're in disrepair. And we say, well, why don't you just spend all of the money on fixing the parks until all the parks are relatively well-maintained, and then we'll get you one more. I mean, the parents who say to the kid, I bought you a new bicycle. Where is it? It's rusting in the front yard. Will you buy me another one? No, we won't buy you another one till you take care of the one you've already got. And they say, well, we have to do it that way. Why? Because the legislature passed a law that we asked for that told the city you can't spend the money on maintenance. You have to spend it on buying new parks that you will also not maintain. Now, I mean, it's like the place is being run by a bunch of crazy people.
It does sort of feel like we've decided that we should, like, buy a fleet of cars that we are never going to take to the mechanic rather than having one or two cars that we actually take care of.
And in a few months, they'll all be on wood blocks in the front lawn, decorating the front lawn of your neighborhood. That's the way they do business. That's Aaron Mesh, the managing editor at Willamette Week. Glad to be with you and always glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Wants a job for any American who wants one, with one exception.
It's time to tell Crooked Joe Biden, you're fired.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. The University of Texas at Austin, not exactly the place I would call as the most conservative place in Texas, are rolling back diversity, equity, and inclusion. And to talk about that, we'll bring on our friend Jen Cabani, who's an editor at the College Fix. Jennifer, welcome back.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going very well, if this is a sign of things to come. Do you think it is?
Absolutely. So UT Austin just slashed all of its DEI funding. It's forcing all of its DEI deans to go back to their professorships. It apparently laid off up to 60 staffers who were supporting the DEI operations at the school. And the reason they did it is because Governor Abbott and the Republican state lawmakers were like, we're going to take away your funding if you don't. So they saw the writing on the wall. This has to do with SB 17, a law that was passed last year that basically defunds DEI offices at all higher education institutes in the state, meaning I think others will follow suit. UT Austin is the flagship in the state.
I guess the thing I notice is people say, this is what we believe in. Oh, there's cash involved. Oh, well, then we don't believe in it anymore. I mean, I'm glad they did it, but it just suggests that their values are either an inch thick and not much deeper, or that their values can be purchased for cash money, which doesn't say much about their values, does it?
Well, I know you're in a good mood. This is good news, but keep in mind, we still have ultra-liberal professors in the classroom who are going to say whatever they want.
True.
Which they're allowed to, of course. It's academic freedom. I'm not saying they can't, but at least this stops the institutionalization of DEI. Now we're just going back to liberal professors indoctrinating your kids.
but you're right about that. Although, you know what I think is the best disinfectant is sunlight. I wish there were conservative, even if it was a tiny group of conservatives, who would go onto campus and identify these crazy left-wing liberals and all the crazy stuff they say in classrooms, and merely take pictures and quote it online and just say, here's Professor So-and-so, here's our favorite statement from Professor So-and-so this week in class. And I would think a little bit of that sunlight shining on those people would make them scurry away like cockroaches, wouldn't it?
Well, you know, that is something that, in fact, the College Fix reports on when these things come up, because they do. Students will post it on TikTok or Instagram or Twitter, and then we will, you know, seek comment from the professor. You know, make sure it's put in context.
Yeah.
And cross some I's and dot some T's. But, you know, when professors saying something egregious, I mean, it's got to be, at this point, there's a lot of crazy things being said. So for it to make the news in today's very busy, very crowded world, it's got to be pretty egregious. But you know what? Professors never disappoint. It seems like every other week they say something outrageous. And I think more and more students, libertarian-minded as well as conservatives and Republicans and Christians, and of course, you know, Jewish students who are absolutely fed up with the rampant anti-Semitism we're seeing on college campuses, they're pulling out their cell phones, and they're holding people accountable.
Well, and the other thing that I thought could be effective is I've always thought the boards of trustees or board of regents, whatever they call it, at various colleges and universities, because it's different depending on where you are in America, the folks who are the board of directors of the university, that if you began to tag them, usually they're put on the board because they got a pile of money or they own a business or there's some other way influential in that community. That's how you end up on the board of regents or board of directors and chancellors, whatever. And just say, hey, are you okay with this stuff? You know, when Professor So-and-so says, from the river to the sea, you know, or we don't want, to go back to 1948, which is the current chant that they're apparently doing on behalf of the Palestinian terrorists. And go to those members of the community and say, would you mind if we published a story with your position on whether or not you're okay with this professor calling for the genocide of the Jewish people? And say, if you're okay with that, then you won't mind us publishing that in the community. And I would think that some of those members on the board of directors, who I think right now are kind of trying to fly under the radar, they don't want anybody to notice that they're the ones who are actually calling the shots. And they're the ones who could call in the president of the university, or the chancellor of the university, and say, hey, why are you letting these people get away with this kind of stuff? Because this is Nazi stuff.
Yeah, for far too long, the boards of trustees have just rubber-stamped whatever the universities want to do, when in fact they do have the power and the oversight to make changes. Some of them are trying to, they're starting to, in Virginia, for example, they're trying to add two new mandatory DEI classes to the graduation requirements at George Mason University, and some trustees that Glenn Youngkin had put on the board are saying, whoa, wait a minute here, so they're trying to derail that. But right now, the real teeth are coming from the state legislatures. In addition to this SB 17 that's forcing UT Austin to cut all its DEI, the Alabama governor just signed a law that defunds DEI offices in Alabama. You might have seen recently the University of Florida, led by Ben Sasse, eliminated all of its DEI offices. There was a new law passed in Indiana that mandates intellectual diversity. So right now, what's leading the charge are state lawmakers sort of reeling back the pendulum here on higher education, but the trustees absolutely should do it too.
Yeah, and if you make sure that all the big donors to the school, and maybe even not just the big ones, maybe all the alums who are constantly being hit up for $1,000 here, $1,000 there to their favorite, you know, alma mater, would say, are you sure you want to send money to these people? Because these are some of the things that you're helping to pay for. And I would imagine, and just like Harvard right now has actually seen a drop in people applying to go to Harvard. And why is that? Because of some of the stances that their kids have taken. Jennifer, thanks for what you do at the College Fix, and we always appreciate your time and your insights.
Hey, it's great to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you as well. That's Jennifer Cabani, one of the editors at the College Fix.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars. Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Consider this poll on X question today. Should the rules forbid a president from firing bureaucrats who won't do their jobs? I'd say no to that. You can vote any way you like. You'll find the X poll question at Lars Larson Show on X. Also on our website at LarsLarson.com and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, I want to talk about teachers and unions and lying to the public to make more money. And Paul Guppy joins me now, who's vice president for research at the Washington Policy Center. Paul, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
I'm glad to have you on for your expertise. Did the Washington Education Association and other teachers unions lie to the parents and the taxpayers about COVID in an effort to make more money?
Yeah, the answer is yes, and it's not just us saying that. That is backed up by research by the New York Times, which found that in the fall of 2020, there was enough scientific information from the CDC to show that schools could open safely across the country, and in many states they did open, but not in Washington State. The union pressured the governor to keep the schools closed for a full academic year after that. And then we did the follow-up research here locally in the state and found that during that same period, top union executives, the president of the union, the executive director of the union, were pulling down salaries of between $300,000 and $400,000. That's all during a time when the schools, the public schools, that is, were completely closed.
Yeah, because for the teachers, unlike a lot of people in the private sector, the paychecks kept on coming, whether they taught, whether they showed up in the classroom or not.
Exactly. Now, you know, the union would say, well, there was online education that teachers were still showing up and trying to teach their students. And we have to hand it to those frontline classroom teachers that did try to stay in touch with their students and advance some learning that way. But as all parents, you know, myself included, if you're sitting at home with your struggling school-aged child, within a week or so, you quickly found out that the online education just wasn't working at all. And a lot of students didn't pay any attention. A lot of classes didn't happen. So even though they were technically working, quote unquote, there really wasn't much learning activity going on. And there was zero activity going on as far as the union is concerned. And yet we found that all union executives still pulled their full salaries during that period.
Yeah, and there was no reason for them to do that. I mean, who are they representing? I guess they could argue, well, we had to represent the teachers because, after all, it was a changing landscape as the rules and whether or not they were going to be open or not were changing as well. But it seemed to be mostly Republican-led states where the schools reopened, and other states like Oregon and Washington, where they were run by Democrat officials, those were the places where the schools stayed closed.
Exactly right. And again, as a research organization, we always look for real world control groups that show how students would have fared if the shutdown rules didn't apply. And you're right. There are countries like Sweden that didn't close down at all. There are states, over 20 states in the U.S. did not close their schools. And then right here in Washington State, private schools and charter public schools opened a year before the regular public system, and those students did fine. So there are many comparisons, objectively following the science, that show that public schools could have opened in the fall of 2020, about 4 or 5 months into COVID. We had enough information to know that younger children are practically unaffected by the disease. Also, that they don't tend to carry it to other people. We knew that in 2020, and yet the union insisted on keeping the public schools closed anyway.
Paul, I remember when we found that out because there was a concern early on, and I thought, well, a lot of times, whether you like it to hear it or not, kids are disease vectors, except it turned out not to be the case with COVID. But there are a lot of other diseases, including nasty ones like hepatitis, where kids can be carriers of it without even showing any symptoms. But they found that out fairly early that they were not. So were you able to pull out any records that showed, you know, where the unions or the state officials admitted they knew that they could reopen and they decided not to anyway?
Yes, because the union itself said that they were following information that came from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control at the federal level. That information showed, as I mentioned, that schools could open safely. Private schools, charter schools, and schools in other states did do that with no damaging health effects to students or to the faculty. And yet at the same time, the same union was putting out public statements, and I have some quotes here. One union leader in Washington State said, teachers will die if students go back to school. Another one said, we shouldn't worry about students falling behind because they're all falling behind together. So it doesn't matter if they're not learning. These are the public statements that they were making at the time when, again, they knew from science and research that came from the federal government that safely opening a school was possible in Washington, and yet the union continued to argue against it.
You know, Paul, there was another issue I wanted to ask you about that relates to this, but are there any other major findings from this that you'd like to share with my audience?
Well, that's basically it. I could go into lots of detail, but I think what people, you know, what we know now from the record is just what I described. They could have opened the schools, but the union didn't want to.
By the way, the one that's bothered me, and I've never seen anybody but this show report on it, is this. And I don't know how widespread it was, but I'll bet you could get the data. And that was the schools, some of them at least in Oregon, decided to game the system. And by that, I mean this. The schools said, okay, all you teachers, you are officially laid off on Friday, and then you're back to work on Monday. So they had the teachers working 4 days a week, and they collected full paychecks. And what that did during that period where you could collect both unemployment plus $600 a week if you were on unemployment, they qualified their teachers for a day of unemployment to get them the $600 a week. And they did that for some period of time. And I remember saying to my producers, hey, guys and gal, I could do this too. I don't think it was legal. It wasn't ethical. It wasn't moral to steal the money. But I could have told my producers, okay, you're off on Monday. Call it in as unemployment. Get your $600. You're off on Friday. You're off on Wednesday. I could have done it. And it would have benefited my staff to the tune of thousands of dollars. The public schools, at least some of them, did that. And I think that's fraudulent. I think it's deceitful, even though it may be technically legal. Do you know whether or not that happened in Washington State?
We have not heard cases of that happening specifically in Washington State. However, that does sound exactly like the kind of strategy that unions and school districts do try to pull. They are, you know, bureaucratic monopolies, and when the rules change, they will definitely work the rules in order to gain an advantage.
I think it might be interesting if Washington Public Policy called the employment division and said, can you go back to 2020 and 2021, or 2020 when the extra $600 a week was going on, and see how many people classified as teachers working were filing one unemployment day a week to be able to qualify for that extra $600 a week, because that was shortchanging, that was cheating the system to the tune of about $2,500 a month per teacher times thousands of teachers. I'd be fascinated to know what you find out. That's Paul Guppy, Vice President of Research at Washington Public Policy Center. Glad to have your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Introducing the Greek god of lousy economics, open borders, and falling upstairs.
I am Joe Bidenopoulos.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. And Phil Kirpin is here from American Commitment. And Phil, you're right to mark a very important fourth year anniversary because we know a whole lot more than what we knew this week 4 years ago when you point out the government initiated unprecedented federal lockdowns of the economy to combat COVID. But I also wanted to add to your what you wrote at Unleash Prosperity. There's a second guilty party, and that is all the state and local officials, because they're the ones who were most in charge of shutting businesses down. The federal government had some power, but the state governments and local governments had a lot of power around America as well. And depending on the state, they did either a lot of it or not very much of it. And it turns out to be really stupid as we look in the rearview mirror, doesn't it?
Almost everything that was done at almost every level of government was wrong. And not just government, but media, public health officials, everyone kind of lost the plot of the main things you're supposed to do in really any kind of crisis, but specifically in a pandemic situation. And we had all kinds of pre-pandemic planning guidance, and they all kind of said the same thing for the number one rule, number one principle, which is keep things calm. Don't panic. Don't freak people out. Don't disrupt the orderly functioning of society. And almost every single thing we did intentionally did the opposite, Lars. Scott Atlas told me that Fauci would walk into the task force meetings in the White House and say, people aren't scared enough. We need to scare them more, which is the exact opposite of what you want. Yeah. And everything kind of flows from that. The lockdowns, the school closures, you know, all of the crazy things that were done so catastrophically wrong, the mandates, all of it, I think, stems from panic, from not following what you're supposed to do in a crisis situation, which is calm things down and keep things out functioning in an orderly fashion. And, it's interesting. We didn't get into this in our report, but looking at all the stuff that Rand Paul put out today and so forth, and I think a lot of the panic from people like Fauci and Collins and others that sort of set the tone from the top was because they knew about their role in funding this research and, collaborating with that Wuhan lab. And that's why they freaked out. It didn't follow, the normal principles.
Well, in fact, I'm glad to hear you say that, because from the moment we found out that they put money into the Wuhan lab, I've been saying to people, if you put yourself in Fauci's head, which I think is a dangerous and toxic place, and you say, I realize I was the one who signed off on Fauci, was the one who signed off on putting that money there. What were they doing? Gain of function research, making benign viruses dangerous to humans. And you say, if you realize that, it's like watching a movie and wondering, why is this one character behaving this way? And then when you realize what his role is in that movie, you say, oh, he's the guilty guy. That's why he was constantly, doing this and that. That made no sense early in the movie. Later on, you find out, oh, he realized that if they find out what's really been going on, they're going to come back to him and say, you made this happen. To a large extent, and so he took actions that were designed to distract from his guilty role.
I think that's probably right. Unfortunately, I think it probably destroyed so much of the evidence that we'll never know for certain, but that's kind of the impression that I got also. And, I mean, it's interesting, right, because the virus itself, based on its characteristics, should not have inspired anything like the kind of panic it did. I mean, especially younger people.
Phil, I think I'm losing your cell phone altogether, but Phil Kirpin is with American Commitment, but he makes a good point. And he points out 4 years ago this week, the government initiated unprecedented federal lockdowns. The cost of all that has now been calculated at $6 trillion in government debt, hundreds of thousands of business bankruptcies, 1 to 2 years of lost schooling for young children, tens of millions of Americans out of work. All of that as a result of the really bad decision-making back then. But, Phil, what other than Fauci's guilt, and pushing back on his own staff when his staff was saying, let's go this direction. And he said, no, 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 we're going to tell them this direction instead. I mean, things like saying all the evidence points to this being an artificially generated virus, and Fauci pushing back saying, no, no, we're going to go with the wet market explanation. Other than Fauci, what else can explain why this country went that direction?
Well, I think there was a panic. It was a global panic, really. There were only a couple of outliers. And the interesting thing is, if you look at the countries that did the best in the entire world in terms of all-cause excess deaths, you know, where did they not have significantly higher deaths than usual through this period? There are kind of two models that sort of worked, right? One was New Zealand, which is wall yourself off from literally the entire rest of the world, test everyone at the border, you know, be ruthless in terms of isolation. That doesn't work if you're not an island, okay?
Nope.
The other country that did extraordinarily well was Sweden. And what did they do? Well, they basically presented the best information they had to the public, and they didn't do anything coercive. They didn't close schools. They didn't order lockdowns. They presented the best information they had, and they said, make good decisions. And they trusted people, and they didn't disrupt society. They didn't panic. And so unlike almost everywhere else, they didn't layer non-COVID excess deaths, lockdown, panic, societal disruption deaths on top of viral deaths. And as a result, they had, you know, they had a little bit of extra death, but it was much less than pretty much everywhere else except New Zealand.
And yet Scott Atlas, who we just talked to on the show a couple of weeks ago down at the Hoover Institution, and his colleague Bhattacharya, who was also on that week, both of them are still somewhat pariahs in the field.
Well, they hate them because they were right. Yeah, I think. I mean, look, right? I mean, the thing is that one of the many problems that we have, and it continues to be a problem, is almost every scientist in the country gets their funding from NIH and NIAID, which is Collins and Fauci. And so if these are the guys that called the shots and this is our response and we're going to do lockdowns and school closures and we're going to scare everyone, if you didn't get on board, you probably weren't getting your next grant renewed, all right? And all the major hospital systems, they get hundreds of millions of dollars in grants. All the major universities, they get hundreds of millions of dollars in grants. I mean, these guys dole out $45 billion a year. So, you know, I think that this is one of the major structural problems we need to fix going forward. The guys who set the policy can't be the guys who dole out all the money.
I agree with that. But, Phil, can I throw a crazy idea at you very quickly? I've been on a Navy sub, a Boomer, right, the ones with the missiles, and they have a blue crew and a gold crew, and one crew goes out and does 90 to 100 days, the other crew goes out. They all run drills, and the one that gets the better marks at the end of 6 months gets more time off. Yeah, they make the two crews compete. Could you imagine if we didn't have one NIH? What if we had two NIHs? They had to compete, and you had to compete to get the grants from them. And then the two agencies had to come back and say, well, we invested this much of your money, and these are the results we produced. They invested the same amount of money, and they got lousy results. Bring some competition to the area of science in the federal government. That's Phil Kirpin from American Commitment. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. Your emails are always welcome. talk@LarsLarsen.com. If you want to check out our Instagram feed, you'll find that at the Lars Larsen Show on Instagram. If you want to tell Alexa to play the Lars Larsen Show, that's always fun. You've got the Lars Larsen Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larsen Show. The Lars Larsen Show. Did you know Lars has a face for radio? Want to see? Follow him on Instagram at The Lars Larsen Show. You're listening to the best of The Lars Larsen Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Loved starting out the day with a naysayer just now. And Dave Honeycutt is a great friend of the show. He's president of the Oregon Property Owners Association, and I want to talk to him about farmland. Hey, Dave, welcome back.
How you doing, Lars?
I'm doing well, except I get tired of people saying, why, we have a law that protects the right to farm in Oregon. And, of course, you have urban growth boundaries that, in theory, protect land so that farms can exist. But is Oregon protecting farmers or farmland?
Well, we've done a really good job for the last 50 years, Lars, of essentially putting a straitjacket on rural Oregon and calling it protecting farmland, but we've done a really bad job of actually helping farmers, those people that we expect to farm that land that we're keeping off limits to anything else.
I mean, I have read recently about the fact that the state has always had these laws on the books, but now they're running around saying, oh, you're a small farmer. Oh, you need a permit on that well. And then they lay down the requirements, and in some cases, the farmer gets cut off from water. Is that what you're hearing as well?
I am, and, you know, one of the things I think probably, Lars, the most, I guess, outrageous thing that we do for our farmers in this state is that not only do we tell them that they have to farm, but then we make it hard for them to have other activities on the farm that'll actually allow them to make some money so that they can continue to farm. And that's the whole point. If we protect the land, but we don't let the farmer make any money, then we're not really protecting anything. We're not saving farmland, we're hurting farmers.
Yeah, and in fact, a few years ago, maybe even 20 years ago, Dave, but I think the laws are the same. I remember talking to this older couple on the air, and they'd gone out and bought 5 acres. And you say, well, what can you farm on 5 acres and make money other than pot or maybe opium poppies? And they said, no, we grow blueberries. I said, well, you can grow a lot of blueberries on 5 acres. And they were making a living. But the wife who did the books for the man's farm, said, well, maybe I'll start doing taxes for other people. And so she decided to start doing taxes from her, you know, basically her kitchen table. And she was, you know, filling out people's taxes every year. It's almost tax time now. And then the state of Oregon came along and said, you can't do that business. You've got to go into town, into a commercially zoned area, and rent yourself an office and do your taxes at a table there instead of a table in your kitchen. So there's an example where the farmer's wife, who also wanted to make blueberry muffins and sell them, and she was told, you can't make blueberry muffins or blueberry bread or blueberry jam or anything else and sell it at the blueberry farm. That's a commercial activity. You have to do that somewhere else. Are those good examples of what the state does to make it hard to make a living on a farm?
They are, Lars, and you make two really good points that I think people, you know, don't really understand about farming in Oregon. Oregon is really a state of small farms. 67% of our Oregon farms are less than 50 acres in size, and 74% of all of our farmers, basically three quarters of them, gross less than $25,000 a year on farming. And so we are a small farm state, which is part of the reason why only about 40% of the farmers identify farming as their primary occupation. Your wife doing the tax work is a prime example of that. And so we have to come to grips. Our legislative folks have to come to grips with the fact that Oregon is a small farm state, and we need, rather than discourage farmers from doing taxes in the house or having a pumpkin patch or a farm stand or a farm-to-table dinner or school tours or things like that, we need to encourage our farmers to do that so that they can make enough money that they can keep the land, whether it's 5 acres or 40 acres, in egg production. It's a win-win for everybody.
I think it is, too. And when they tell me you can't build housing on that, it's got to be saved for farming. Dave, one of the problems, we always hear about how housing affordability is, and it's gone to hell under Joe Biden. I mean, it went from where you had to make $60,000 a year 3 years ago to where you have to make over $100,000 a year across America to buy a house. And you say, okay, that's affordability there. Dave, every time I've run the numbers on farming, unless you inherit the land or you win the lottery or you have a high-dollar city job like lawyer or doctor, nobody can afford to farm, can they?
Well, and you raised you raised a couple of other good points. We've had, you know, we've had what we call the $80,000 rule in place for almost 20 years, actually for over 20 years, Lars. And that rule requires a farmer to make $80,000 in farm income for 2 years in a row before they can build a farmhouse on their farm. And so what we expect is young people to go out there and buy 80 acres because we can't have, you know, we can't create farms any smaller than 80 acres now. So they have to go out and buy 80 acres, and they have to rent a place in town, and then they have to go out and farm, and they have to make at least $80,000 for 2 years in a row. And then we might let them build a farmhouse that they can live in on the farm, which is precisely one of the reasons why the average age of Oregon farmer just continues to rise. We make it really hard for young people to get into the industry, and it's a shame.
I mean, because the numbers don't pencil. I remember doing it with grass seed farmers a few years ago, and I said, well, you know, how many acres do I need to be a grass seed farmer? I was just curious. And he said, about 100. I said, what's that cost, you know, in the Willamette Valley? And he said, well, about 10,000 an acre. I said, so I need to buy 1 million acres of land. And then, you know, can I make a living on that and pay the mortgage? Because the mortgage on $1 million is probably $50,000-$60,000 a year alone. And they said, well, you can either pay yourself or pay the mortgage, but you're not going to do both off 100 acres of grass seed land. And I said, isn't grass seed one of the most, you know, lucrative kinds of farming there is? And they said, yeah, that's why there's so much of it. Oregon supplies almost all the grass seed for America, and I think about 30% of the grass seed for the entire planet. And I said, so you're telling me that nobody could actually get into this business and make it pencil out unless they have a big pile of money already, right?
Well, exactly, and it's really why we just need to come to grips with the fact that we're primarily a small farm state. We ought to encourage our small farmers. We ought to make it easier, or not completely easy, but easier for young people that want to get into farming to get into farming. And then once they get into farming, we need to allow them to go out and do some direct, really, it's direct marketing, Lars, is what they need to be able to do. They need to get people from Portland to drive out on a Saturday afternoon in October to bring the kids and grandkids and pick a pumpkin and ride the train and go through the corn maze and do all of those things that people like. Not only does it allow the farmer to make some money, but it makes them a direct connection with people in town who think their food comes from the grocery store.
Well, and in fact, they also have all these other limitations. Yes, you can have the pumpkin patch. Oh, you want to sell hot chocolate? Not allowed. Not a farm activity. You want to sell people apple cider? Well, I guess if you grew the apples there, but otherwise it's a commercial activity. It's almost like a bunch of elites got together and said, we really like the view of all the farmland, and we like all the green, and we want people to farm, but we're not going to make it possible for them to earn a living at it, but we're going to keep them from selling their land for anything else, so we'll force them to be farmers, and they end up being the feudal serfs of all the people who live in the big cities. Dave Honeycutt runs the Oregon Property Owners Association. Dave, thanks the primer on that, and I appreciate the time. Your emails are always welcome, talk@LarsLarson.com. If you want to check out our Instagram feed, you'll find that at the Lars Larson Show on Instagram. If you want to tell Alexa to play the Lars Larson Show, that's always fun. And, of course, you can always call the show, 866-439-5277.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Biden doesn't understand the connection between America's tanking economy and his own tax policies. Luckily, Senator John Kennedy set him straight.
If you believe that tax policy has nothing to do with the economy, then you're pretty much like a rock, only dumber.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. As you may know, 7 hackers tied to the Chinese Communist government have been indicted for targeting U.S. businesses and U.S. politicians. So is China trying to push to start a cold cyber war? I thought I'd put that question to Miles Yu, who's a senior fellow and director of the China Center at the Hudson Institute. Miles, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me again, Lars.
I guess we assume that if there are hackers in China and they go after targets in the United States, that they're not doing it on their own, that they're doing it with at least the backing or the knowledge of the Chinese government. But would that assumption be wrong?
No, it's not wrong. I even go even further. China is a hacking target. Is not just the United States. It hacks everybody. I mean, you UK, you know, Finland, Belgium, and EU, you know, and the African Union, and Australia, New Zealand, India, you name it. I mean, Japan, South Korea, every country has been reporting about Chinese hacking, organized hacking assaults against those countries. So United States definitely is the biggest target of all, because we simply have too much of what they want.
What do we need to do to protect this country from that, then? And is there a way to do that?
Well, first of all, we have to build up our self-defense, number one. Number two, we have to carry out the principle of reciprocity through diplomacy, through warnings, and if not, we won't let the perpetrator know that we have capability to stop them and initially to basically destroy their capabilities.
Is there a way to respond in a cyber way to these attacks and tell China, if you keep this up, we're going to set some of our cyber assets loose on your country as well?
Well, definitely, that's probably definitely the last resort. But in this cyber war, which is kind of shadow warfare anyway, and we must establish a set of rules of engagement first, and to lay out the rules, regulations, what you can do, what you cannot do, we let them know that we have the capability to detect you, and ultimately to destroy your capability if you don't follow the rules. So, and I think, you know, the cyber area is a new frontier of modern life. So there is definitely a lack, at least an insufficient set of rules to proceed with. That's one of the reasons why the U.S. and its leading allies are starting to establish kind of an example, to set up some kind of rules of engagement. For example, we just signed a deal with Great Britain to set up the sort of cybersecurity rule and to set some parameters. I think we're doing this with a whole bunch of other countries. You know, there is the Budapest Agreement. As far back as 2001, there was an agreement about international effort to punish cyber crimes. So China constantly sort of skirting that kind of regulations. We need to strengthen that.
How much of this is happening along with the Chinese government's efforts to get companies like Huawei into various other countries so that they will have back doors into the computer networks of the United States? I know we've rejected Huawei to a large extent, but it doesn't mean private companies are rejecting it.
Yeah, well, there's every country has some pranksters, some kind of, you know, loners, some losers doing that on their own. So you cannot prevent that. But in the Chinese case, it's 100% the state-sponsored, organized cyber crimes targeting the most sensitive, the massive databases of other countries. I mean, United States, China, basically in the state to organize, only the government of China has the capability to do so. So to organize, for example, to organize a cyber attack and stole basically the entire federal employees,
of personnel management,
right?
Yep, OPM.
That's right,
yep.
The OPM. That was way back in like almost like 20 years ago, and then it's been going on, you know, as recently as last November. So this is the 100% organized crime perpetrated by a state.
And how much of this is being done as sort of a feint or testing to see how far they can get before they get caught, where China would say, well, okay, we've got seven of them charged in the United States, wire fraud, computer intrusions. So some of this looks like financial crime, but some of it was computer intrusions apparently aimed at political officials as well in our country, which means they're looking not necessarily for money, but they're looking for information. So are they just testing the waters a bit to see where, how far they can get before they get caught? Or do you think we're beyond that?
That's a part of it. China has this understanding of the new frontiers of cyber, artificial intelligence, undersea space. Those areas, they think nobody is actually dominant. So they want to sort of, what Chinese always say is, seize the commanding heights. So they want to basically set the rule. And that's very dangerous. But I think, you know, it's not just testing the ground. China is actively collecting massive human data. Biometrics, consumer habits and our credit rating system, Equifax, for example, and Amazon, because China's economy is based upon modern technology to a large degree. Modern technology wants to use that to create a global dependency on Chinese technology. And today's technology, to a large degree, depends on how much global data you actually have in order to have global dominance. You know, that's why China has tried to collect every country's massive data, hotel registration information, the driver's license, the DMVs, national health care, you know, Walmart. So whenever you have a large collection of data, consumer data, by the hundreds of millions, China, those are the primary targets. Artificial intelligence, for example, is crucially dependent on how big a database you have. That's what China is doing.
That is Miles Yu, Senior Fellow and Director of the China Center at the Hudson Institute.
Larson Show.
You ready for the big show?
You're
ready. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. But I want you to consider this. Why has the state of Oregon effectively immunized? I'm not talking about the jab. I'm talking about immunized, meaning made them not subject to the rules. Why have they immunized killers and violent criminals under the age of 18? Thought we'd talk about that with our friend, D.A. Josh Markey, or former D.A. Josh Markey, who joins me now. Josh, why did it happen?
It happened because late at night in the spring of 2019, the Democratic majority decided to repeal what voters had twice passed. Originally called Measure 11 in 1994 and was reaffirmed by 75% of the voters in 2000. And that law, which again, voters twice voted on, said that older teenagers, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds, who are convicted of the most violent forms of rape and homicide, not even all homicides, not even all rapes, would stand trial and as adults and would serve time first in a juvenile facility and after they turn 25 as adults. Because of what happened late in the night, in the evening, with the connivance of some Republicans, but mostly Democrats, excluding Betsy Johnson and Brad Witt, that was completely repealed. And voters may wonder, and listeners may wonder, well, whatever happened? Why don't we hear about these cases anymore? Because they're essentially secret. We don't know what's happening with them. Reporters can't find out about them. And if you try to get a docket, you won't find anything.
In other words, there is a record, but not one where the public would easily get it, of what happens to juvenile killers and rapists.
Not just easily. I mean, this has happened with friends of mine who are journalists. Let's say you find out that a 17-year-old has been arrested for, say, one of the all too many shootings in Portland. And let's say you're lucky enough to find out that the person's being arraigned. We still have public courts in America. Even for juveniles, they're public. If you went to the Multnomah County Courthouse and said, I want to know when Johnny Jones is being arraigned, they won't tell you. And the docket doesn't show it. And what you're really talking about are secret. You know, the whole reason we have public trials, why we have those benches in courtrooms, is because the public's business is done in public. And to make sure that people like the elected DA do their job. It's hard to measure. Well, we do know that crime is out of control in Oregon, and it's out of control with what Schmidt's doing because we can see it, and there's a direct correlation, but hard to measure it.
Yeah, and in fact, he doesn't seem, even though he's running for re-election, he's running against Nathan Vasquez, who I have to mention is not willing to, I don't know why he won't, he ghosts us. We've tried to ask him to come on and talk about the specific things that he finds fault with in Mike Schmidt so we can understand, is there a difference between Vasquez and Schmidt? He won't do it, which makes me immediately suspicious of somebody who's seeking public office who won't show up in public and answer questions. I'd put him in the Joe Biden category. I'd like to have the job. I don't want to answer any questions about it. Always makes me suspicious. Should I be?
No, I don't think you should be. I mean, I don't know Nathan well. I've contributed what I consider probably more money than I have, and I'm obviously speaking out on his behalf. He is not he's not a politician, and he has very, very little experience with the media. He's running, you know, one of the ironies about district attorneys offices are you really don't want a politician in the job, but of course it is a political job and you do have to run for office. There's a reason for that. I wouldn't normally take up this much time, you know, talking consistently about one person as I do Mike Schmidt. And it doesn't affect me personally in the sense I don't live in Portland, but one needs only Portland to see how bad it is. And there are very few other jobs where one person can make so much of a negative difference, because the district attorney decides ultimately whether cases will be filed. And ultimately, as we can see in Portland, the Portland Police Bureau just stops trying, because there's no point in trying to pursue a case when you know that the DA's office, and Schmidt has stepped in and yanked cases away from career people. And as we learned from the Oregonian, credit to Noel Crombie, who they did a story, I think last week, about using the public records about when actually people come into the office. Schmidt is coming in apparently about 60% of the time, yep, compared to about 90% for the DAs in the around.
Which means
county.
He's out of the office 40% of the time, again, just like Joe Biden. I want to ask you about something else. So last couple of weeks, I've talked about this 9-year-old girl who was raped at Scott Elementary. And I've had people say, well, how can you say for sure it happened? I can just say that the reporting indicates it happened. The father of one of her assailants, you know, if convicted, it would be rape, but it's a child. And we don't know the names of the people. We don't know how old they are. They may be the same age as her or older. But if you were when you were DA, because you were DA just a few years ago in Clatsop County, if you came to know that a crime had been committed against a 9-year-old girl and you were the DA, could you pursue a case?
Absolutely. The only time when effectively the criminal system can't be used is if the suspects are under the age of 10. There is a presumption in our legal system, although it can be overcome, that a 9-year-old is not capable of forming the criminal intent. Now, that doesn't mean, even under the previous laws, before they mangled Measure 11, juveniles over the age of 14 could be brought into adult court. But even if they weren't brought into adult court, even if, say, they were 13 or 14, there would be a juvenile case. And one of the things that's commonly misunderstood is people say, oh, it's secret. No, it's not. The media has simply decided, and for some reasonable reason,
they don't want to report on it. Yep.
They don't want to basically
in the last minute I've got, Josh, with you, tell me this. I'm not suggesting that if her assailants were 9 that they should go to prison or even juvie. But if a case were brought, that at the very least those 2 9-year-old boys, if they were 9, would be in front of a judge and the judge could set conditions, could they not? Find you're not a delinquent, you're not guilty, but you're a dependent of the court. And the court could say, I'm going to require the parents to put you through some counseling or some behavior modification, and I'm going to put some limits on what you're allowed to do, you know, so that you're not going to end up in this situation again and you're not going to hurt somebody. A judge could do that, correct?
Absolutely. That's the purpose of the juvenile system.
And Mike Schmidt, even though the schools violated the law, he could bring charges against people at Portland Public Schools for failing to report this crime, couldn't he?
Absolutely, yeah.
And he's choosing...
It's a crime.
It's a crime.
It's an infraction, but yes.
But yeah, he could go after them for failing to follow the mandatory reporting law. Josh, thanks very much. That's former DA Josh Marquis.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Sometimes the truth is awkward.
You know what the Muslims call the Jews in the Quran? The children of Israel. Well, this is awkward.
Now, more truth from Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. It serves Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. And one of our good friends is Todd Myers, Environmental Director at Washington Policy Center. Hey, Todd, I know we had planned to talk about honeybees. Can we talk about that in a moment? But there's something else I want to throw at you, and I don't usually do a change-up on you, so you'll forgive me for doing it today?
Absolutely. I'm ready.
Okay. Over the weekend, there was a story broke in Politico Pro, solid source. Scientific American has written about it as well. So that's sort of the mid-grade between science, which is unreadable by lay people like me, and popular science, which is basically just a big place that's full of ads for power tools. But right in the middle is Scientific American. So a University of Washington researcher has decided to do experiments on weather modification, and apparently, you know, with climate in mind, because I think that's where the grants are coming from the federal government for that. And they've put a cannon, kid you not, on a defunct aircraft carrier that's parked in San Francisco Bay. And they said they're firing salt crystals into the air. Except, unlike most scientists, they did not make a big public announcement about it. Now it's out where people can see it, so people start asking questions about it, saying, why are you firing these microscopic salt crystals into the air? And they said, well, we're going to make more clouds, and we're going to make the clouds more reflective of sunlight to protect planet Earth from global warming. And I wanted to ask you about that, because even some of the science types have been saying, you know, doing this in largely in secret, not quite all the way off the books, but not certainly, you know, announcing it to the public what you're doing and saying that you're going to change the climate change weather. If you change it one place, you're likely to have effects in other places. I mean, if all of a sudden Seattle started doing cloud seeding and got all the rain to drop on the west side of the Cascades, Ellensburg and Spokane might not be too happy with that. Yakima either.
Yeah, and so the idea, this has been floated a number of times. And so what they're called, in this case, it sounds like cloud seeding. In other cases, what they put up over are called aerosols that block the sun. So when Mount Pinatubo erupted, you actually saw a big reduction in global temperatures because of all the material it put up into the air. This is slightly different than that. But yeah, so there is a theory. The question is, how much uncertainty? What are the unintended consequences as you raise? And one of the things that I like to tell people is that the climate is not a thermostat. We don't know enough to, you know, turn the knob up or turn the knob down. And sort of ironically, the people who are most upset about this are actually the people, the climate extremists on the left, because they don't want solutions that reduce global temperatures that don't involve societal transformation. So the irony is that they actually have opposed these sorts of things because they say, well, if we can do it this way, or we can do carbon sequestration, pulling CO2 out of the air and storing it, then we don't have to do societal transformation. So I think it's very funny. There's nervousness on all sides, and I think that there should be. I think these sorts of things are interesting, but obviously they're not, I don't think they're ready for prime time. And as you note, they should be transparent, and we should be really certain about what we're doing before we start playing games, thinking that we're smarter than the climate.
Well, and let me ask you about this. Maybe the numbers are just so big that it really doesn't matter. But I've had at least a few people, and I had the idea go through my head as well, and they said, Lars, when you start pumping all this microscopic salt into the air, and then the rain falls, it's going to carry the salt back down. Now, I do recall from my history that the Romans used to wreck people's farm fields by salting them. Is this really a terrific idea, or are the quantities just not enough to make a difference?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. But again, these are the sorts of questions that you need to ask, because there have been more than one occasion where people get myopic about one thing and don't think about the unintended consequences down the road. But I know that several people are looking at this, but yeah, I think in the global scheme of things, this is probably not one that's going to make a difference at the end.
Yeah, I just wonder, because it seems so bizarre, and the fact that they've chosen a place like San Francisco. Maybe they thought they'd be embraced in San Francisco. Oh, and we're glad you've arrived with your salt cannon, because you're going to fix the planet, because that place is notoriously cloudy. So it's kind of seems silly to go to a place that, you know, what did Mark Twain say? The coldest coldest winter he'd ever spent was the summer he spent in San Francisco. And they're going to go down and say, hey, folks, we're going to make more clouds and more rain in San Francisco. I can't imagine anybody getting on board that.
And anyway, a salt cannon sounds like something I'd use in my cooking.
Well, actually, I have an assault rifle that I use. It uses plain old kitchen salt, and it's for knocking out bugs, you know, like flies and things like that. When you're sitting outside and the fly keeps flying around your barbecue and you shoot him with the assault gun, then he's gone. And it's clean. And
probably
it's
a better use.
It's biodegradable. Hey, let me ask you about honeybees, because you're a beekeeper, and people have been saying for a long time that honeybee populations are declining. What's actually happening?
Yeah, not just declining, but collapsing. And in fact, we keep hearing this time and again that honeybee populations are collapsing. You see signs that say no bees, no food, all of these sorts of things. And of course, invariably, the environmentalists blame it on pesticides. Pesticides are killing all the honeybees. Well, we have been saying for years that honeybee populations are not collapsing, and actually they are climbing. And a new comprehensive census done by the U.S. federal government finds that not only are honeybee populations not declining, they actually increased over the last decade faster than any other livestock. They're considered livestock, and they increased by about a third. And we've been saying this for a while, and the reason is that beekeepers have a strong financial incentive to make sure that their bees are healthy so that they can get paid for pollination services for selling honey. And so we have seen a mite called the varroa mite, which attaches to bees and weakens the bees and does cause increased mortality. We are seeing a larger percentage of hives die. But beekeepers are replacing those hives faster than they are dying because of those free market forces. And so all of the politicians, all the environmental activists who want to put all more regulations are forgetting that the market is more powerful than those regulations. And that's why we've actually see honeybee populations increasing.
Well, and didn't you tell me, that, if I recall right, that this is the amateurs. These are the, like you. You know, they're not the professional beekeepers. They're saying my bees are going down, and they're the small fry. And they're trying to say that whatever's happening to the hobbyist honey beekeeper is happening to the whole industry, and that's not the case. Am I right about that?
That's exactly right. And so when you look at the studies, it is the small time, you know, the hobbyists who don't have those strong financial incentives. I want my bees to live, but if they don't, you know, I'm not losing my livelihood. Commercial beekeepers, that's not the case. And the other thing that's interesting about that is that commercial beekeepers have the lowest rates of mortality of any beekeepers, despite the fact that their bees are most exposed to agricultural pesticides, which
because that they know what they're doing. Todd, I've got to go, but that's Todd Myers from the Washington Policy Center. Back in a moment, you've got the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Welcome to Honestly Provocative Talk. But fair warning, if you're listening to this show, you're likely on the FBI's most wanted list. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Proud to say, and I've told my friend Dr. Henry Miller this before, he's a medical doctor, molecular biologist, sometime naysayer on the Lars Larson Show. He's also at the American Council on Science and Health. And Doc, I told you, my mom was a nurse, and before she died, when I was 9, she gave me a measles shot. And I got tested a couple of years ago, and more than 50 years have gone by, and apparently it's still working. But apparently America, which officially eradicated measles more than 20 years ago, almost a quarter of a century ago, has now seen a dramatic outbreak of this disease, and we want to know why. Welcome back, Henry.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Lars. You know, one of these days I'd like to be on your program with good news, but I don't have that today. The short answer is that the percentage of people vaccinated with measles vaccine needs to be very high to induce herd immunity. It needs to be about 95%, and it has shrunk to overall about 92%, and that's why we're seeing more and more cases. So, as you said, it was virtually eradicated almost a quarter century ago, but it's back because of vaccine hesitancy and vaccine rejection. And so up to a couple days ago, we've had about 97 cases this year, more than double what we had in all of 2023. In certain pockets, there is significant resistance to vaccines. The Orthodox Jewish community in parts of New York, the Somali community in Minnesota, and from there it can spread to the unvaccinated, particularly kids. So it's very worrisome. And I read recently an article on the BBC website about a 10-year-old girl who died last year of complications of measles that she contracted 9 years prior.
What? Catch it and it actually exhibits itself 9 years later?
Yeah, it's a rare but really awful illness called subacute sclerosing panencephalitis. And if your listeners are interested in finding that article, they can just search for BBC measles and Salford, S-A-L-F-O-R-D, which is the town that she's from in England. A beautiful 10-year-old kid dying 9 years after contracting measles. And the reason that she wasn't vaccinated was she contracted measles in just a month or so before she was eligible by age. So this is not something to take lightly, and we really do need to keep up with measles vaccination.
Well, let me ask you about something else, though, because you and I would agree that there are some diseases that could be affected by two or more major factors. You've identified vaccine hesitancy. And because, I mean, I know that measles is contagious enough that if I were to walk into the bedroom of somebody who has measles, who's resting in their bed as they try to recover, if I didn't have immunity, I could catch it just by being in the same room. It's that contagious a disease. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Studies have shown that an infected person with measles will infect 90%, roughly, 90% of unvaccinated people that he or she comes in contact with.
And but not just contact, like some diseases that are spread by direct contact or sexual contact or blood exchange, but just by being in the same room. Because it's airborne as well.
Airborne, yeah. Absolutely. You know, that's why it's particularly hazardous when kids who are susceptible to measles and might go to school before they've developed frank symptoms and infect other kids who are unvaccinated or who are immunocompromised because they've had a kidney transplant or they're being treated for cancer or they have some other disease. So it's really not a good situation.
Ask you about the other factor. We've just seen more than 10 million people come into this country in 3 years, and they came in under such, you know, this is the Joe Biden invasion. And am I right in guessing that that most of them have been coming from countries where vaccination is not all that common at all?
I think you're right, and I think that's a real hazard. That's yet another reason to reject these irresponsible border policies of the Biden administration.
Well, absolutely. And the other thing that you and I talk about all the time, and that is trust in the medical system. Do you think I'm right to assume that in the current environment where the Biden administration wants to say, no, the border's under control, and they say it over and over again, and it's clearly not under control, your own lying eyes can tell you it's not, are we likely to get the truth from the public health agencies that gather this kind of data? Because most of it, for most of the population, is going to be gathered in big, politically blue cities, you know, by public health departments, and then reported back to big, politically blue agencies like CDC. If they see a pattern and say, a lot of this appears to be coming from this massive number of largely unvaccinated people coming into the country from largely third world countries where they came from, are they going to tell us the truth about that?
Well, I can't tell you definitively. I would say that I hope so, and that they don't gain personally by fudging data.
No, but they could gain politically. They could say, if I come out with this study that shows a large percentage of these cases come back to a patient zero who came into the country illegally, whether you call them a undocumented illegal alien, undocumented Democrat, refugee, asylum seeker, whatever. But if we come out with a study that says there is a connection here, the White House ain't going to like it. And neither are the Democrats, because we will have imported not just child trafficking and drugs and sex trafficking and criminals and potential terrorists. We're importing disease as well. Could you see that big agencies, which tend to tilt to the left politically, might say, well, we're going to find a way to present those numbers that doesn't make that connection clear. And you know they can do it. Right.
I can't tell you definitively. I can't see into the heads and the ethical, the moral compass of people in the public health departments in Chicago and New York and Philadelphia and Los Angeles. I can't do that. So the answer is I don't know. One other thing I wanted to mention before our time runs out is.
Sure.
There's another infectious disease problem brewing, and that's with avian flu, which we've discussed before. It now has infected cows, mammals, in five states, and there are two human cases that have evolved from that, people who have apparently caught the illness, the virus from the cows, and this is brand new. We don't know whether this is going to make the virus more susceptible to infecting humans and permitting human-to-human transmission, but it seems much more possible, much more likely than it did previously.
So I mean, is there something about diseases that if they jump from birds to cows, that kind of jump may cause mutations that are more likely to make humans susceptible as well? Is there any science there?
It's more likely that they've acquired mutations that make them more able to jump to different species. And what we're especially worried about is what's called antigenic shift, and that's co-infection of, say, an avian flu virus and a pig or a human flu virus at the same time, and then you get reassortment of the RNA set of the genome, and you get a brand new novel virus that nobody has immunity to, and it can be very virulent.
Unbelievable. That is Dr. Henry Miller from the American Council on Science and Health. Henry, thank you very much.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Is your workplace...
What does Lars think about smoking the devil's lettuce?
I won't go schizo, will I?
It's a distinct possibility.
Now it's time to take a hit of Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Isn't multiculturalism great? Baltazar Perez Estrada, 33 years old, entered the United States illegally. He was welcomed into the country by DHS, Department of Homeland Security. He was just arrested in Chicago for killing and beheading his wife in front of his small children. Yeah, multiculturalism, it's fantastic, isn't it? Glad to be with you and always glad to take your phone call. Seton Motley joins me now, president of the group known as Less Government. Seton, how are you?
Well, you know, it's my you know, of course, I live in Belize now. And one of my jokes is between the U.S. and Belize, only one has English as its official language, and it ain't the U.S. You know, when I visited for the first time in August of 22, I go down to the village in Plasencia, and I see a Mennonite with his beard and his blue shirt and his pants, laughing with a Garifuna, which is the black Caribbean population down here, with dreads down to his ass, and they're in the village talking and laughing. And one of the ways to cut through all the racial BS that's in the U.S. is to have everybody speak the same language.
Yeah, and really.
Because they both speak English, they get along. There's a ton of different races down here. There's three different Mayan races down here, and there's no racial crap at all. Literally none.
And by the way, Seton, this idea, I've told people before, and maybe I've bored you with this before, but one of the things way back when, my first visit to Israel, they have a program called the 555 program. And while they don't require it, they highly encourage people who are planning to move there and, you know, and emigrate there and then live there. They say you go to class 5 days a week for 5 hours a day for 5 months. And what do you learn? You learn the language. You learn how to read it, how to speak it, how to write it. You learn about cultural things that are different there than they are here or wherever you came from. And I thought, what a tremendous idea, you know, that, and I'll bet there are plenty of groups, civic groups in America that could do that kind of thing. And if you said you want to legally emigrate here, we don't want you to be locked up in sort of a cultural isolation by your language or by not knowing the culture and the do's and the don'ts here. But if you come here and there's already a community made up that speaks your language, what incentive do you have to learn any other language?
I remember, you know, I flew up to D.C. for about a month ago, and I had to go to Bank of America for a, you know, cash infusion of U.S. dollars. So I was tipping people in the airport in Belize dollars, and they're looking at me like I was from, you know, Belize.
Monopoly land.
Yeah, and the Bank of America ATM had 8 languages to choose from. You know, one of my favorite phrases, Teddy Roosevelt, who opposes dual citizenship, who opposed multilingual, he called it you can't run a polyglot boarding house, meaning you can't turn the U.S. into a multilingual country because you're undermining the common threads that tie countries together. And, you know, one of the reasons we're, you know, we stand around, like, why is it so partisan? Well, because we speak 8, you know, you get 8 different languages on a freaking ATM machine.
And by the way, can I tell you one of the ones I want to keep reminding people of? When somebody like Ilhan Omar goes and speaks to a group, Tlaib's Michigan, Ilhan Omar is Minnesota, and she goes and gives this speech to a bunch of Somalis. And because somebody took the time to translate it from Somali into English so we could understand what she was saying, she was telling these people, I'm a member of Congress, but my 100% loyalty goes to Somalia. So that means you get away with talking to groups of people that you want to have come and vote for you, and the rest of the people will not understand what you're promising them, because most of them, if she delivered that same speech in English, I think Americans would have said, hold on, your allegiance should be to this country, your work should be for this country, not for a country on the other side of the planet.
I wrote a piece about 20 years ago called Campaigning in English, Governing in Arabic. That's what we're getting from Tlaib and these others. It's just, it's insane. You can't do it. If we had a media, of course, they'd report the fact that she's pledging her allegiance to Somalia. It reminds me of, remember, you know, San Francisco's a disaster area, 365 days a year for years. And then the actual boss of California and San Francisco shows up, Xi Jinping from China, and they clean up the streets and they get rid of the tents and they get rid of the drug deals.
No, and back to the multicultural part of it, I don't know how it is in Belize. I suspect it's probably pretty good, but I still remember about 20 years ago, the Mexican consul in the town where I was working as a reporter was griping. He said, they've got this 25-year-old guy locked up in a local jail. And I asked him, I said, what's the problem with that? He said, well, he's locked up because he was having sex with a 14-year-old girl. And I said, yeah, that's illegal. That's rape where we are now. And he said, yeah, but right. Back in Mexico, it's not rape. And it's like, you're not in Mexico anymore. And when people tell you about multiculturalism, understand that some of that culture has to do with what the rules are about little girls in America, and understand the threat that may pose to you and your family.
Well, and it's, again, I'm very much pro. I came here not to turn Belize into the 51st state. I came here because I want Belize to be Belize. If you're going to come to America, you have to respect, or wherever you move, you have to, the world doesn't change for you. You change for the world. And if you change your locale to a new country, you have to melting pot yourself into the new culture. You can't bring your old culture with you.
Except that's exactly what they're doing. That's Seton Motley from Less Government, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.